Now, we have been teaching on church history longer than I normally teach on anything. In fact, I'm surprising myself. I've passed two or three juicy quitting points that I could just leave you there and wondering, will I ever come back and teach on this subject again? And I just kept going. Can't believe it. And I would like to keep on going until we solve the problem of what happened between 70 A.D. and 100 A.D. Now, if it were easy to ferret it out, there wouldn't be a tunnel. If this were an easy problem to solve, you could go to any library, and church history would start with the founding of the church on the day of Pentecost and be as detailed in the happenings in the first century as it is in the second century. Church history deliberately clouds that first century, because the church that entered the second century was much different from the church that God added to daily after the day of Pentecost. Now, the Protestant Reformation was supposed to go back to the beginning. Didn't quite make it. The Pentecostals and the Charismatic Revival supposed to go back to the beginning. Didn't quite make it, because we're all captured. You can't go back to the beginning. It's like trying to go through a train car by car to a different engine than the one that's pulling the train you're on. You want that slow? If you start from the caboose and go from car to car, the engine being reverse your thought a little bit, friends. The engine being the beginning of history on a particular subject, church history in this case, and you're in the caboose, First Assembly of God, 20th century. And you're going to find what's starting this thing. So you go car by car by car as it rattles along the track. You don't really think you're going to eventually go through a car and end up in the engine that's on another track, do you? Well, that's the way most people approach church history. I mean, they're already on the track. King James. The doctrines and the creeds, apostles, Chalcedon, Nicene, now what we're trying to do is just have a big old train wreck. Now you understand what's been happening to your mind? Reading from the coming of the saints. Now, we have traced the church at Antioch to the point of the Apostle Paul getting in a tiff with Barnabas or vice versa and leaving. The church at Antioch was the first deliberate, widespread attempt to convert Gentiles to the church. Up till then, it was primarily a Judaic splinter group. And you all can sit down and turn the lights down upstairs. The leader of the church at Jerusalem was the son of Joseph by another marriage. The husband of Mary, the mother of Christ. And you find early on a tendency similar to that in the Islamic faith. The ultimate, or not the ultimate, but the initial division of the Islamic faith was over who should succeed Muhammad. Now, there is a difference because the church worships Christ and the Muslims do not worship Muhammad. That's why it's simply Western error to refer to the Islamic faith as Mohammedanism. They are Muslims or Islamic. And the distinction between the Sunni and the Shiite sects and all subsequent splinter groups is exactly on that point. Should the successor to Muhammad be the prophet, be one of his relatives with the family in control, or someone else? When Jesus ascended and the church was born on the day of Pentecost, James became the leader of the church in Jerusalem, James the Just, not James the Apostle, though there are some who say they're one and the same. James the Just. And the indications are he did not become a follower of Christ until after the resurrection. He wasn't one of the original 12. He wasn't imbibed with the teaching of Christ. Indeed, his family sought to lay hands on Jesus, thinking he had gone mad when he began to preach the claims about himself. But in Jerusalem, the persecution was early on. And those passages following Acts 2 show persecution after persecution, with the stoning of Stephen. The persecution so intensified, all left, save the apostles. That's what caused the close associates of Christ to get in a boat with Joseph of Arimathea and be set adrift into the Mediterranean, ultimately ending up in the south of France and on to Glastonbury, the part of church history usually neglected in the traditional accounts. The persecution was not from the Romans, it was from the Jews. And acceptability by the Jews, no doubt, conditioned the choice of James. All records, Jewish records, Christian records, show James respected by the Jews for his studied adherence to the law as practiced by the Pharisees. Had he stayed in control of the whole church, there never would have been a question raised. To be a Christian, you had to be circumcised and add the Jewish law to the work of grace and to the gospel news of salvation. You don't have James going to Antioch saying to the Jews, quit putting your requirements on the Gentiles. You have representatives from James coming to Antioch and intimidating by their presence the Christians that were not abiding by Jewish regulations and intimidating Peter and Barnabas, who until the crowd from James came were eating with the Gentiles. You don't have James leading some argument at Jerusalem when Paul came down, censoring the peeping Toms who crept in unawares, as Paul has it in the Galatian letter, and spied on their liberty that they have in Christ. You don't find James rebuking that invasion of their privacy and saying such requirements were not necessary. In every case, you find the newcomer Paul stirring up the Jews and forcing them to a compromise, but never to a yielding. Had it not been for Paul, Paul was the great stir contributor to the New Testament church. Without Paul, Christianity would have been shaped in the pattern of the Jerusalem church, a splinter of Judaism, pridefully demonstrating that they could outperform the Jews in their own law because of the power they had in Christ. Then that would have been Christianity. Period. Circumcision, as much as baptism, would have been the liturgical event to confirm your salvation. James, the brother of Christ, so called, thus dominated the Church of Jerusalem. As we trace the history of the Church of Jerusalem further, you will continue to find so-called natural relatives of Christ moving to preeminence. Simeon, a son of Clopas, Cleopas, Paulus. And as we go on in Eusebius, the natural so-called relatives of Jesus will continue to play a prominent part in Jerusalem until Jerusalem is destroyed and the Judaistic faith, in essence, becomes outlawed. Then it becomes more to the advantage of the Christians to separate and be seen as distinct from the Jews than to continue the identity. The synagogue was the first meeting place. Even Paul continued to go to the synagogue and debate there. But it is critically important to understand that without Paul, the church would have been a splinter group of Judaism. And the apostles, radiating out of Jerusalem, did not generally agree with Paul. And the compromise in the first council that produced the letter of Acts 15 was exactly that. James did it. James did it with an authority that wasn't based upon some majority vote of the apostles present. James wrote the letter. James made the decision. Having listened to the arguments, Peter argued for some compromise. Paul, I'm quite sure, was as unyielding as he continued to be in his Galatian letter, because he refers with some bitterness in Galatia, "These who seem somewhat before men contributed nothing to me." And the letter was a compromise. You don't have to keep the whole law of the Jew, but you must keep the kosher laws of Leviticus 17 and 18 and avoid pornography as described therein, primarily incest. Then Paul heads west. Peter head somewhere. Mark is picked up after his failure with Paul and becomes tutored by Peter. There are some who argue he was Peter's natural son. That issue will never be settled. Others say his statement, "Mark, my son," refers to the spiritual relationship they had. Mark writes an epistle with Peter. Not an epistle, but a gospel, the shortest one. It's to become the source of the other two synoptics, Matthew and Luke. Mark goes to Alexandria and founds the church in Alexandria. Their source of teaching is his gospel. Various writings claim to have come down from the apostles themselves, and most likely the Didache, the so-called teaching of the 12 apostles. They don't have epistles from Paul at the outset. And at Antioch, when Paul leaves, the compromise having been injected by the letter from James, Matthew arrives to write his gospel. And that's about where we left things, to summarize it quickly. But a mystery cropped up concerning James the apostle. There is a missing 10, some say 14, I prefer 10 years. Peter, James, and John, not James the brother of the Lord, James the apostle. They are always together, Peter, James, and John. So much so that that's caused a lot of the confusion in the minds of those who study the early church, thinking that the James the Just was none other than James the Apostle, because that makes a Peter, James, and John still around. But James the Just was stoned or thrown from the parapet, stoned to one account and beaten finally to death with a club. And all tradition agrees with that. And James the Apostle was beheaded. And we haven't gotten around yet to who wrote the epistle, have we? Which one of these Jameses? What happened to the James the Apostle? Well, let us consider in the coming of the saints by J.W. Taylor some of the traditions. It will be noticed on reading the earlier chapters of the Acts of the Apostles that there is an almost unaccountable absence of the name of St. James the Apostle from the company of his fellow apostles, St. Peter and St. John, and we read nothing of him until the brief account of his martyrdom, when Herod the king killed James, the brother of John, with a sword, in Acts 12. This is said to have taken place in A.D. 44. You can date it by the famine that came during the reign of Claudius. The famine had been prophesied by Agabus, and it is that fixes the date around A.D. 44. Where was St. James, and what was he doing during the 10 years preceding of his unrecorded labor? Now, one of the reasons why some people say 14 years is they make the error of dating the death and crucifixion of Christ as 30 A.D. And for years, the birth of Christ was assumed to be 4 A.D. More modern scholarship has confirmed what the pyramid said for centuries. 2 B.C., not 4 B.C., is the birth date, and the 4 B.C. was based upon an erroneous reference to a piddling little eclipse referenced in Josephus. Well, modern scholarship now confirms the date of Christ's birth, 2 B.C., and the crucifixion in the spring of 33 A.D. But old traditions that started 4 B.C. and had the crucifixion in 30 A.D., then 44 A.D. as the date of James' beheading, would make 14 years. The better constituted calendar makes it more like 10 years. From 33 A.D., death and resurrection of Christ, to A.D. 44, where was St. James? And what was he doing during the 10 preceding years of unrecorded labor? St. James waited in Jerusalem as he had been directed until the first day of Pentecost. Acts 1:3 makes that clear. But from this day until that of his death, any notice of his life is wanting from the records of the Bible. St. Peter and St. John were together at Jerusalem during the years immediately following, but nowhere do we read of the presence of St. James with them. This is remarkable, because he had been constantly with them before this. Sole sharer with them of the special revelation on the Mount of Transfiguration. Not James the Just. James, the brother of John. Sole sharer with them again of the final conversation in the Garden of Gethsemane. Not James the Just. James the Apostle, the brother of John. I want this to begin to settle in. James the Just didn't follow Jesus around. James the Just wasn't taught by Jesus, didn't have these experiences. You read his epistle, you'll begin to figure out which one wrote it, James the Apostle or James the Just. James the Just doesn't have a bank of Christ's teachings on earth to draw from. He's going to draw from the Hebrew literature. He was a Pharisee of the Pharisees. As Jesus was a devout Jew, so was his so-called brother. Why do you think the angel had to go and talk to Joseph, the father of James, who would marry Mary, the mother of Christ? The husband of Mary was a devout Jew. His sons, born before the marriage to Mary, in the natural appearance of things, half-brothers to Jesus. But if the virgin birth be true, not naturally related to Jesus at all, stepbrothers. His background is Jewish. He puts the Jewish stamp on the church. Doesn't sound too foreign. Those that traveled with Jesus witnessed him teach the Pharisees the deeper meaning of the law. It takes Paul on the other side of the resurrection, when the kinsman redeemer had done his work of identity and done his work of paying the penalty, the price of redemption. It takes Paul to understand the new dimension that came through the death of Christ, which was the death of the law. But to James, there was no death of the law, and appointed to the position by the apostles as head of the church. He's going to keep the legal stamp on it. Where'd James go? Now, there's some very old traditions reaching back to the earliest centuries, which, if accepted, thoroughly explain this phenomenal silence regarding one of the chief of the apostles. And these, St. James is represented as a distant traveler in the West in the very earliest years after Christ, and as a missionary pioneer in Sardinia and in Spain. These traditions about St. James, this writer says, are so old and so definite, however improbable they may appear to be, that I make no apology for reproducing their more prominent features. They represent the Apostle James as coming from the East, and that's where we stopped. We got right to that point, didn't we? Here we are again. I've been confused, Los Angeles says. Didn't Mary have any children with Joseph at all? I've always thought that Jesus had some half-brothers and sisters. Help. No evidence that he had any brothers and sisters by Mary and Joseph. Joseph was an elderly man who died while Jesus was still young. And the brothers and sisters were by previous marriage. Playing the worldly music, Los Angeles says. Showing the worldly horses. And teaching God's truths. That ought to set the James crowd back a step or two. Dallas, Texas. Did Dr. Scott get his degree from Stanford? PhD from Stanford in 1957. I have people go check up on me every so often. I think you should. Go in the library and read my dissertation. It'll do you good on Reinhold Niebuhr. Now, there are some very old traditions, the coming of the saints by J.W. Taylor. There are some very old traditions reaching back to the earliest centuries, which, if accepted, thoroughly explain the phenomenal silence regarding one of the chief of the apostles, James, the brother of John. The triad or trio, James, John, and Peter. Suddenly, another James is prominent after the death and resurrection of Christ, a stepbrother of Jesus, James the Just, who puts his Judaistic stamp on the church. What about the other James? He shows up about A.D. 44 and is beheaded. What happened between 33 A.D. and 44 A.D.? 10 years at least. These traditions about St. James are so old and so definite that I make no apology for reproducing their more prominent features. They represent the apostle as coming from the East and preaching the gospel both in Sardinia and Spain, and then returning to Jerusalem for the keeping of the Passover festival at Jerusalem, and suffering martyrdom during this visit to the church and to his friends in Palestine. His body is reputed to have been taken care of and brought from Palestine to Spain by loving disciples who buried him in Spanish ground among the people to whom he had first preached the gospel of the kingdom. A fact mentioned by contemporaneous historians, both Tacitus and Josephus, make this mission antecedently more probable than it appears to be at first sight. About A.D. 19, we are told, and that's where we quit, by Tacitus, the heathen Latin historian, that 4,000 youths, affected by the Jewish and Egyptian superstitions, were transported from Italy to Sardinia. These are spoken of as 4,000 Jews by Josephus in his Antiquities, the Jewish historian, and it is evident that their banishment and forcible enlistment, for they were used as soldiers in Sardinia, made a profound impression on Jews in Palestine, 4,000 of them being imprisoned and shipped off to Sardinia. Some have supposed that these banished Jews were already believers in Christ or followers of the teaching of St. John the Baptist. But this is hardly probable. It is, however, quite possible that many of them may have been followers, old followers of Judas the Galilean. Now, who's he? Read Acts 5:37. Who had been living as prisoners in Rome during all the succeeding years. If so, they or their families from which they came would be personally known to James and John. They would indeed be lost sheep of the house of Israel and would have a special and urgent claim on the sympathy of the great apostle. Hardly. They would be Jews, and that's that. But would no doubt be viewed by the Jews as lost sheep, and certainly a concern for the Jews. 4,000 of them carried into imprisonment in Sardinia would have their attention. The active belief in the legend or tradition of the Spanish mission of St. James appears to date from about A.D. 820, when the body of the saint was, quote, discovered by Theodosius, Bishop of Tyre. Around the reputed body of St. James, there gradually grew the shrine, the cathedral, the city, and finally the pilgrimages of Santiago de Compostela, or Compostela. The original cathedral was consecrated in A.D. 899. And this was destroyed by the Moors under El Mansui in 997. The later cathedral was founded in 1078 A.D. on the site of the one which had been destroyed. But long before the supposed discovery or rediscovery of the body of St. James, we have evidence that the essentials of the tradition were held by Spanish inhabitants and Spanish writers. Now move Mick over to direct, Joe. And the sound is killing me tonight. You got too much bass in it. I'm talking about the sound in this room, not the sound that's on the air. Sound waves are powerful forces. And when this microphone in here is set a certain way, about 10 minutes of talking and I'm in pain. Send Joe down here till he can listen to these speakers. Is that one on at all? Is this one on? I think it's in the mix. He might be able to fix it up there. Now, what has just been said is that the so-called body of the saint was discovered by the Bishop of Tyre around A.D. 820. Relics were not an early, important part of the worship of the church. When relics and sites came to be venerated, the body was gone from the tomb of Christ, so it was lost from history. And they still fight over two competing locations. When relics begin to be emphasized, you then have people discovering. I have a very skeptical attitude toward relics, but when the relics of a particular saint are heralded as being found in a particular place and only in that place, and no competing claims are made anywhere else, what it indicates is that the traditions of the presence of that saint in that area long preceded the finding of the relics. Be skeptical, as I am. Assume the worst. That the relics are a fraud. as we found in Colonel Voss, and you're getting a little better with the sound. In fact, it's getting to a point you can now turn it down a little and I can still survive. But the pain is gone. The Colonel Voss, if you'll recall, forged some relics in the pyramids. But he didn't find and claim to find the relics of an emperor of the Ming Dynasty in the pyramid. Nor did he claim to find relics of an Aztec chieftain. The relics are alleged to be relics of someone that other history and tradition locates in that area. Jeremiah was so important, it is highly improbable that anyone, anywhere, would come up with the idea out of whole cloth that the burial place of Jeremiah would be in Ireland. Yet it is the only place claiming his burial place. And as I've said many times, there are more Jeremies among the Irish than any other language. You don't find claims for the burial places of that little band around Jesus, the Bethany household being the central core, Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, except in the south of France. If you don't find some place in India claiming that group, you don't find some place in Turkey now, you will find competing claims for Mary, the mother of Christ, because she was so venerated and so important in the eyes of many of the new first century Christians. She didn't just stay in one place. There is evidence of her presence in Britain. There's evidence of her presence in the south of France. There's evidence of her presence at Ephesus. And you will find competing claims for her burial because there is evidence of her presence in all those places. You don't find that in James's case. James was so important to the early Christians. Beheaded in scriptural record in Palestine, how come we don't have the claim for his burial there? And we ship bodies, even in the modern world. Now, they took the remains of Mark from Egypt to Venice. A tradition has it they took the remains of James to Spain, the place where he spent just about all of his ministry, if these traditions are true. So the finding of his body presumes a looking for his body, which presumes a legend that his body is there, which presumes a history before 820. That's the point I'm making. It's obvious. Long before the supposed discovery or rediscovery of the body of St. James, we have evidence that the essentials of the tradition were held by Spanish inhabitants and Spanish writers. From immemorial times, or at least from A.D. 400, we find references to the tradition in old Spanish offices. In the latter part of the next century, which would be the 6th, and beginning of the 7th, about A.D. 600, there are three distinct references confirming the tradition of the preaching of St. James in Spain in the writings of Isidorus, Hispalensis. I can pronounce Spanish if I work at it. He's Palencia's. I've never read him. But I have encountered his name many times. He's one of the classic authors about Spain. In Book 7, three different references. Book 5, one reference. This writer tells of James' body as having been buried in Marmarica. The tradition is again confirmed by St. Julian, who ruled the Church of Toledo, or Toledo, in the 7th century. In his Acta Sanctorum, volume 33, page 86. And again by another writer, Preculpus, who wrote about A.D. 850. The summing up of the Bolendus in the Acta Sanctorum, or Sacred Acts, appears to be decidedly in favor of the thesis that the reputed Spanish mission of St. James is reliable and historical. You want to hear more? Now we have James in Spain. We haven't said much about it because we're reading traditional church history, and they deliberately cover up that fact. We have Joseph of Arimathea and the closest associates of Jesus in the south of France, and the first church above ground being built at Glastonbury, and Joseph of Arimathea converting the British king's house of the Silurian kings. Caradoc not converted. His father converted. His daughter Gladys converted. His son Linus converted. Caradoc is captured through treachery, taken to Rome in chains. His speech to the Roman Senate is recorded by Tacitus, the Roman historian, verbatim. So moved the Senate that instead of being slain, he was given house arrest, parole, and the income, a stipend from the Silurian kings. His daughter is married to Rufus Pudens, who is encountered first as a Roman soldier, his name on the hides of land given to Glastonbury by the kings of England. So he was there on duty with the Roman soldiers, no doubt met and won the hand of the king's daughter, Gladys. He's now a Roman senator. Gladys has been adopted by Claudius, the Roman Empire, her emperor. Her name changes to Claudia. She shows up in much of the heathen literature. And Paul references Rufus Pudens' mother as the mother of both Paul and Rufus Pudens. So he is either half-brother or full-brother to Paul. And we have two churches with powerful connections to the rich and the rulers. The whole family of the Silurian king, attentive to the gospel as preached by Joseph of Arimathea, Caradoc becoming a Christian after his arrival in Rome, Linus, his son, appointed the first bishop of the church at Rome by Paul and not by Peter. Those are the facts pushed aside in the traditional church history that is written throughout the Middle Ages under the control of the Roman Church. This independent origin of the French Church, this independent origin of the British Church, and subsequently the Irish Church, covered up in traditional church history. Peter being credited with appointing Linus, they cannot argue that Linus was the first bishop. But they have Peter appoint him instead of Paul, which is simply not true. And the evidence for Peter's visit to Rome is somewhat shaky. And it is rooted and grounded on an allegorical or metaphorical interpretation of Peter's own words in his epistle, that he, with Mark, greets them from Babylon. If Babylon is to be taken literal as a town on the site of ancient Babylon, And then he's writing from far east of Rome. Two of the church fathers make the claim that he is metaphorically referring to Rome as Babylon. And that becomes the fundamental criteria, claiming his position at Rome and the writing of the epistle by Mark to the Gentiles at Rome. If he was in Babylon, the other place, most likely Mark wrote his gospel in the east and journeyed down to Alexandria. It is very clear that Matthew, writing his gospel at Antioch, and Luke is from Antioch, these two gospels draw heavily on Mark. We haven't yet agreed that Peter and Mark are at Rome, metaphorically called Babylon. That's another subject. But the covered-up history of the church fails to mention that it was a powerful kingship, never conquered by Rome, swaying the Senate when captured through treachery, and their household became...
This is the end of Side 1. For more of the teaching, please turn the tape over for Side 2. Thank you.